As commented on by other speakers on this program, the use of anthracyclines in the adjuvant setting is being reconsidered in patients with both HER2-negative and HER2-positive tumors, and one non-anthracycline regimen that is increasingly being utilized is docetaxel cyclophosphamide, so-called TC. I met with Dr. Ruth O'Regan for her take on this issue and also to learn about her research in neoadjuvant therapy. Dr. O'Regan began our conversation by commenting on the U.S. Oncology trial evaluating TC.
It's a really interesting study. The problem is it is somewhat small for an adjuvant study, but it had node positive and node negative tumors on it, which certainly was very useful. I think the data shows that the disease-free survival is better with the TC and the overall survival, although not significant, but at least was numerically better than with the TC. And obviously it has a different side effect profile. When I've given TC in my practice, I find docetaxel is hard to give, certainly at the 100 milligram per meter squared dose, but this regimen actually is relatively easy to give. So it does
make...
That's right. So it does beg the question of whether you need AC or not. But on the other hand, most patients do very well with AC, and it is kind of the tried and tested chemotherapy regimen.
It's interesting because initially when Steve presented this at San Antonio, I heard a number of people question that the trial showed that TC was more tolerable than AC. But on the other hand, I don't think that many people had used TC. And now that I hear people have used it, it sounds like a lot of people agree. And again, I guess it's because the part of it is because the docetaxel dose is lower.
Right. And, they don't get any nausea really with it as well, which is quite nice. And then I think we also have the whole issue of the Herceptin Adriamycin-based regimen, which is another whole issue
right.
as well.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the research you're doing at Emory?
One of our major focuses at Emory is the triple negative cancers because we have a large African-American population in Atlanta, and we and also the Chapel Hill group have shown that in young black women there is a particularly high incidence of triple negative cancers. About 50% of them actually end up getting triple negative cancers versus about only 25% in their white counterparts. So the other thing that we see a lot is we see a lot of patients with very large cancers. So we are very interested in preoperative trials. So we have two or three preoperative trials that we're kind of designing right now. And one of the issues, obviously, which a lot of people are interested in is to try and work out, why a patient responds to one drug and why another patient doesn't respond. So one of the trials we're looking at is a fairly straightforward trial, which is comparing docetaxel for 4 cycles followed by capecitabine for 4 cycles. It's more a dose-dense, not a dose-intense dose of the drug, where you give them every 2 weeks together. So the docetaxel and capecitabine every 2 weeks again for a total of 8 cycles. So the arms are balanced based on the doses of the drugs on each arm, the number of cycles and the drugs that we're using. But I think one of the things that we'd like to look at on this trial, because we're assuming that we'll get at least a substantial amount of patients with triple negative cancers on this trial, is to try and work out what we all know is that some patients with triple negative cancers respond very nicely to chemo and some patients with triple negative cancers don't respond at all. And I know certainly other people are doing that, but I think it's important that we kind of differentiate a little bit better what exactly is a triple negative cancer, because it seems like they're not all the same. So the patients on these studies will have a biopsy, obviously, at the beginning, in the middle, and then at the surgical specimen at the end. The first arm is docetaxel at the 100 milligram per meter squared dose every 3 weeks for 4 cycles, followed by capecitabine at the standard doses for 14 days every 3 cycles. The second arm, they get capecitabine along with the docetaxel, but the capecitabine is only given for a week, and that's going to be given every 2 weeks. Kind of similar to, I know Larry Norton has some data looking at a 2-week schedule of capecitabine. So what we were trying to do was basically have the equal amount of doses on the sequential and the concurrent arm.
And what do you want to look at in the tissue?
So we actually have one of those nanotechnology grants. So what I've been doing in my lab is basically using nanoparticles to better quantify the proteins that we know are important in breast cancer. So we're going to look at certainly a whole pattern of proteins, obviously the usual ones, ERPR and HER2-NU, using these specimens, but also other ones, obviously including EGFR, which appears to be important in the triple negatives. And then we also hope to do some proteomic analysis to try and work out are there other proteins essentially that are important in determining response rate on these trials.
Maybe you can explain to somebody who's not too good at basic science how nanoparticles helps you find these proteins.
One of the problems is right now we're kind of developing it, but what we've used basically is nanoparticles called quantum dots, which have been available for quite a long time. And they're obviously very small particles that you can conjugate to antibodies for proteins, essentially. And really the aim of what we're trying to do is to use a very small specimen, like a single section of a cancer, and detect multiple proteins at the same time. same time and quantify them. So there's obviously some teething problems with this, not just with the quantum dots, but also with the microscopy that we need to actually quantify the proteins. But our hope would be that you could perhaps take a breast cancer aspirate and be able to gain information on, you know, up to 100 proteins using these quantum dots on just a single section. But as I say, that this is what we're aiming for. We've got about up to 5 proteins right now on one piece. It's a matter of, I think, automating a lot of what we've done before and making it a little bit more user-friendly.
There's really a major trend, thank God, towards these kinds of research studies. It's too bad it didn't start 20 years ago.
Right.
I mean, I guess you have to have the technology to look at the tissue, but the basic concept of doing something like this really is pretty intuitive. How big does a tumor have to be? I assume you can't use non-palpable tumors, and how big does it need to be in order for you to be able to do these 2 biopsies you want to do?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, certainly anything over a centimeter we can certainly work with initially. Now, of course, one of the problems with all these pre-op studies is that you do, of course, get some patients who respond so well that you've nothing to look at.
Right.
But, I mean, you always have, obviously, the initial biopsy. At the Emory site, we actually give preoperative chemotherapy for very small cancers on the assumption that the patients are going to do the same, whether you give it before or you give it after. So I would suspect that we will mostly have, from the county hospital, quite large cancers. But I think down at the Emory site, we'll probably have some small cancers too.
Now, this is obtained through fine needle aspiration or core?
Either. I mean, our pathologists do quite a lot of fine needle aspirates at Emory, but out in the community where we're also trying to run this, they will definitely be doing core biopsies. And I expect they'll definitely accrue patients with larger tumors.
How do you find patients responding to this type of trial? Obviously, it's introducing at least one extra biopsy, maybe 2. I don't know. How do you find people responding to that?
I think in general they respond very well to it, actually. I mean, the only thing that is extra that they wouldn't have done is the aspirate or the biopsy in the middle of the treatment,
right,
because they would have had the biopsy done in the first thing.
So you're thinking about this when these people walk in the door, basically.
Well, that's right. And they're a bit complicated because obviously the surgeons have to be made aware of the issue. But what we're actually doing with the nanoparticles, you can do in paraffin-embedded tissue. So most of our surgeons do freeze tissue, but certainly in the community they don't always do that.
Is Bill Wood involved in this project, surgery?
Absolutely, yeah. And he's a major proponent of pre-op chemo. So he would be the person that will send you the 1.5, 2 centimeters for chemotherapy. He's also very interested in the whole tissue acquisition thing. So to have somebody like him spearheading it, in fact, but all our surgeons are really very interested in it. And obviously having a county hospital, there's lots of patients down there that need pre-op chemo.
Again, how do the patients respond to being involved with this type of research?
I think they respond very well. You know, I think anytime you're trying to do a phase 2 study, they're always going to wonder, well, how does it differ from the standard of care? But because we're going away from using anthracyclines a little bit, as we were talking about earlier, I think it actually makes a trial like this much easier to sell. And I think one thing you could think about doing is giving them an anthracycline after the chemo if you wanted to, because there's still that big question out there about whether patients that have residual disease need more therapy or not.
We've been doing more and more surveys of patients with different kinds of tumors. We find a lot of interest in research. I mean, that's basically why a lot of people go in clinical trials. And I think this kind of research makes sense to a patient. You know, we want to look inside your tumor while we give you these
Absolutely.
Drugs.
Absolutely. I think they want to know as much as anybody else why a drug works or it doesn't work for them or anybody else.
What other preoperative studies are you thinking about or doing?
So the other one that's fairly far on development is one for HER2-positive cancers, which is going to be Abraxane plus trastuzumab, essentially for 4 cycles, followed by Navalbine plus trastuzumab for 4 cycles. Again, that will have the same biopsy acquisition in the beginning, in the middle, and at the end as well. With HER2-new, one of the questions that comes up that I would be particularly interested in would be the whole issue of, you know, if you have estrogen receptor or progesterone receptor on these cancers, how much do you have? Do the tumors behave the same way as they do if they're ER negative? That's kind of one of the things we'd be interested in. But again, you know, we'll be looking at a whole gamut of proteins, hopefully, in these tumors as well. And again, everything is going to be correlated with pathologic complete response rate at the end is going to be the endpoint of both these trials.
Any thoughts about nab-paclitaxel clinically in terms of the data that's out there, clinical utility? Are you using it in a non-protocol setting?
I am using it. I think I'm a little surprised that it hasn't been used as extensively as you would have thought, particularly in the first-line setting. I think most people still are using it in patients who failed at least one taxane, whereas the first-line data, I mean, it's pretty robust on that trial, and certainly it looks like the toxicity profile, bar the neuropathy, is better than regular paclitaxel, and it was more effective. So I have a couple of patients I'm using it in the first-line setting. I tend to use the three-weekly schedule in the first-line setting and maybe the weekly later on. But then, of course, we have Bill Gradisher's data, which, although it was only a randomized phase 2 trial, really showed that this agent was considerably less toxic than docetaxel, although the docetaxel was given weekly, but also it did also look more effective in terms of response rate. So I don't
see... seemed like it was double the response
rate. That's right, and the weekly schedule... That's right, and the weekly schedule appeared to cause less neuropathy as well. So I imagine that I think this is a prototype of the kind of way we're going to go with these type of agents going forward. I mean, I know that there are several other paclitaxel nanoformulations in development out there. So I think we're going to see a lot more of these type of drugs going forward. But my experience, it seems to be well tolerated. Neuropathy is an issue, but again, a lot of patients I've treated have had prior taxane, so I'm not quite sure how it's going to perform the first line setting with regard to that.
And there's also this elusive thought / statement of, quote, the neuropathy resolves quicker than paclitaxel. Any thoughts about the data on that or your own clinical impression?
Again, I haven't really been able to tweak that out in my own patients. I think that data is a little weak in my impression, because if you look at certainly the pivotal trial, I think there was only 5 patients in the paclitaxel arm they looked at versus saying there was 20 in the Abraxane arm. And although it looked fairly convincing, I mean, the numbers were very small. I think it is possible, because of the way this drug works, that it may be quicker to resolve in terms of the neuropathy. But again, I guess I'd like to see some more data looking at that. It's a little weak, that data.
I mean, if it really were to turn out that in the long run, 6 months, a year later, there was less residual problem, I think that would be very positively viewed by oncologists. What do you think?
Oh, I think most certainly, because everything else they looked at in terms of toxicity, it actually looked better. So I think that may be the one thing that has kind of prevented its widespread use rather than paclitaxel.
And I guess the other thing I get mixed responses to is just how useful is it clinically to have a shorter infusion time and the lack of premedication. Some people feel it's, you know, it's a fairly major benefit and others aren't too impressed. How do you view that?
Certainly, in theory, that's a huge advantage, particularly the lack of premedications, because, as you know, what patients complain about Taxol is having to get all the steroids. They really don't like it at all. So I think that is a big advantage. I'm not sure we've pushed it forward as much as we should. In terms of the infusion side, obviously that is an advantage, but I would imagine that would be a huge benefit to a busy practice.
You commented on the fact that this agent is not being used as much as you thought it would be used. What do you think the reason is?
I think it's probably cost more than anything else. That would be definitely
my
feeling.
Yeah, I do too. I love to get like poll questions and things out, and you always see heterogeneity in how people respond. But when I say, if paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel cost the same, would you use paclitaxel? I get a pretty uniform response of no.
Right.
Is that the way you'd answer it?
That's what I would answer as well. I think that because paclitaxel is generic, there's a huge difference in cost between the drugs. But then we use lots of expensive drugs, so you know, you kind of still have to wonder a little bit.
Well, sometimes what I've observed is it takes a while for docs in practice to sift through things, think about it. You know, they want to be cautious, et cetera. The cost thing's on a lot of people's mind, et cetera. But it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next year.
Right. And as I say, I do believe they're going to have some competitors too as well.
You think some things that'll be available in the next year or two?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, you know, Berlex have the Tocosol paclitaxel, which is actually an interesting agent. It's a formula, paclitaxel formulated with vitamin E, but again, it is a nanoparticle, and that's actually in an international phase 3 study, which has accrued. So obviously, it would be interesting to see what that study shows, but there's at least one or two other agents like that out there in development.
It's interesting, too, if you poll oncologists, as we've had, and say, how would you compare the effectiveness of NAB to paclitaxel? Most people say NAB looks a little better. How would you compare the overall safety tolerability ratio? Most people say NAB looks somewhat better. So we'll see how the cost and financial thing sort of shakes out in terms of getting patients the best possible therapy, I guess.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that you've seen some people use NAB plus bevacizumab. Do you think that that is a reasonable non-protocol alternative, or do we need to see more data?
Well, I'm always wary of combining agents together that haven't been combined before, because you could theoretically think you're combining a nanoparticle with, you know, an angiogenesis inhibitor. Well, you might get enormous penetration into the normal tissues, for example, which could be a safety issue. So I tend not to use those combinations until I at least have seen some phase 2 data. There was some phase 2 data at the combination at the San Antonio meeting, which looked like it appeared safe, and that's usually enough. I think in terms of using a combination, when you know that the likelihood is they are going to work together, I think if you have a phase 2 study showing that at least it's safe, I think that is generally a reasonable route to go.
What about in the adjuvant setting? There have been a couple of smaller trials that have looked at dose-dense AC-NAB. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that?
Again, I have to say I would be a little bit reticent to use that in the adjuvant setting unless we had data, although there is maybe a couple of patients that I've had, or maybe one patient where the paclitaxel was contraindicated because they couldn't take steroids or something. You know, I gave it to them and they had a horrible reaction. And in that case, I have used it maybe on one occasion, but I would not routinely do it, absolutely not.
When you were talking about the triple negative tumors, which there's a lot of interest in now, justifiably, I was thinking about some of these diagram things that Steve Schack was showing me at San Antonio, these like cluster diagrams they have off the Oncotype, where he says, you know, these are the triple negatives. This is, you know, you look at it and you kind of see that. What are your thoughts about what we know about the biology of triple negative tumors, and how do you see assays like the Oncotype helping us figure out the biology?
I think that the Oncotype assay as it stands right now is probably not going to be that useful for the triple negatives, because if you look at the genes that make up the Oncotype assay, they really, a lot of them make a lot of sense in terms of what we know about the biology of ER positive or hormone receptor positive cancers. I think we have a long way to go with the triple negatives. I think we always think about the fact, well, there's no targets in these. Well, actually, if you look at the genes that kind of pan out in the triple negatives, EGFR is overexpressed in 50% of the tumors.
Can you put that in context, for example, compared to non-small cell lung cancer or sort of other kinds of tumors?
Again, one of the problems with EGFR, as you know, is that it's all over the map in terms of how it's expressed. If you look at the initial data for breast cancer, it was going from 10% up to 90% expression. And I think the same is true for lung cancer. And of course, more recently, we now realize that in order to actually have these drugs, the way they work are the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that really it appears the target is this mutated EGFR, which we haven't looked at that in any great detail in breast cancer. But
it's been looked at, I think,
but it's got a low expression, about 15%, I believe, or so. But we haven't looked at the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, particularly when those mutations are present. And in fact, as you know, there was 4 trials that looked at the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors in unselected metastatic breast cancer, and the results were incredibly disappointing. I mean, there was really responses in maybe 2% of patients in those trials. And the issue is that if you don't know what your target is, it's always a little bit difficult to kind of design these trials. I think that we will see some more interest in these agents going forward, perhaps particularly the EGFR mutations in breast cancer, and perhaps that will be a marker of more effectiveness in the breast cancers like it is with the lung cancers. But clearly EGFR overexpression itself is not the answer, because in fact, if you look at those trials, there was one trial with EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors that broke patients down on whether they were hormone refractory or ER negative. And actually the hormone refractory did appear to benefit somewhat from the, in this case it was gefitinib, but the ER negatives did not respond at all. There are some areas that these agents may be useful in breast cancer, but we haven't found it yet.
Any other sort of biologic clues about the triple negatives?
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that the c-KIT is actually overexpressed in 20%. But again, as you also recall, imatinib has been looked at in unselected metastatic breast cancer, and the trial was actually closed early because there was actually no responders, regardless of if any of the targets were there or not. So again, I think whether there's a way that you could maybe turn on these pathways a little bit more, maybe using an mTOR inhibitor in these triple negatives, will be one way to go. And we have a little bit of lab data suggesting that if you use an mTOR inhibitor with erlotinib, you do appear to get some synergy in some of these triple negative cell lines. So I think that's an area that might be worth kind of exploring. And I think the other thing that we always say is we don't have targets in these triple negatives, but it does appear that some of them at least are very sensitive to chemotherapy and perhaps also angiogenesis inhibitors.
What are your thoughts about the new NSABP neoadjuvant study, B40? It's going to look at several different chemotherapy, mostly based around docetaxel plus or minus bevacizumab.
I think certainly looking at bevacizumab in the pre-op setting makes perfect sense. Again, we're not part of NSAP, so as far as I recall from that study, there was docetaxel and then there was a gemcitabine arm
And a capecitabine arm.
Right. And I guess the issue is, does adding more chemotherapy in at this point, is it going to make a huge difference? Obviously, we don't know that. So I think that's an interesting question. But I think using the bevacizumab, and particularly, which the NSAP do very well, looking at molecular correlates of activity, I think is going to be very interesting in that trial.
What are your thoughts about what's been looked at and seen so far in terms of tissue and sera as it relates to bevacizumab?
Well, I think it's somewhat confusing because I don't think we really have any idea exactly what the target is for this drug. 12 months ago, Kathy Miller did present some preliminary data. They were looking at VEGF and RECAM and some other markers, but she didn't really find any correlation between the response to bevacizumab and these markers. So I guess it's another one of these agents where we're kind of searching for a target, but we know it works. But I think that's an important question. I think the preoperative setting offers a huge advantage in basically being able to answer these questions because it's so easy to get tissue, and at least you always have some tissue to look at in these studies versus the metastatic setting where historically it's very hard to get serial biopsies in that setting.
What are your thoughts about bevacizumab in general? Are you utilizing it in your patients? What do you think about the data that's available?
I am utilizing it. I mean, obviously, again, as we talked about earlier, one of the major problems with bevacizumab has been the issue of coverage for the patients because it's so expensive. When you think about the 2100 trial, the progression-free survival increase of nearly 6 months is quite impressive, certainly maybe compared to the combination versus single-agent studies that we've done before in metastatic breast cancer. In my experience, it appears to actually work well in patients. I mean, most of the patients I've treated, they've had at least some type of a response, although perhaps not sustained as long as you would like. And I like it because it doesn't have overlapping toxicity with the chemotherapy. So apart from a little bit of hypertension and some headaches, they do appear to tolerate it well.
When you've used bevacizumab, has it just been in the first-line setting or also second-line?
I've used it almost exclusively in the first-line setting, and I've used it almost exclusively with paclitaxel. This is actually one area where I think nab-paclitaxel is being used. I have seen some patients from the community who've been getting nab-paclitaxel plus bevacizumab. That's certainly an expensive regimen for sure. I think maybe a couple of patients I've used it out of the first-line setting, but as you would expect, you really do not get that many responses. I do wonder, though, if there are certain patients that may be reasonable to consider, that those patients that have these locally recurrent cancers rather than metastatic disease, I think it would be interesting to look to see if perhaps they're a little bit more sensitive to the bevacizumab, because some of those patients are very hard to treat.
What are your thoughts about using other chemotherapeutic agents with bevacizumab, for example, capecitabine?
I think it probably would work out being fine to give it with capecitabine. I think, unfortunately, of course, we have a somewhat negative trial in the second-line setting, which can use bevacizumab and capecitabine, although there was a response rate improvement in that trial. I think I would agree with most people that it's the line of therapy used rather than the agent you use it with that's important. And, you know, at San Antonio this year, there was an NCCTG trial that did docetaxel, capecitabine, and bevacizumab, and certainly showed some activity, although, as you can imagine, it was a somewhat toxic regimen. So I think there is emerging data suggesting that it does appear to be effective with other chemotherapy agents rather than paclitaxel. So I think if I have somebody who's not a candidate for paclitaxel in the first-line setting, I have at least on one occasion used capecitabine plus bevacizumab.
When you utilize bevacizumab plus a chemotherapeutic agent, it's usually paclitaxel. Do you continue the therapy until progression?
In general, I think if they're continuing to respond, I'll continue both agents until they progress, like was done on the trial. Of course, the big issue out there is whether you could drop the chemo and continue the bevacizumab, and I personally haven't done that. I mean, I think one of the problems with trastuzumab is that's what we started doing, and we've left a lot of unanswered questions with that type of approach. In some ways, it may make more sense to continue the bevacizumab on its own, but I think that needs to be really addressed in a trial, I think, for sure. I think that's an important question.
Any other pre-op studies that you're thinking about there?
Well, I think one of the areas that I think is interesting in pre-op is the issue of the fact that we know that if you have an ER-positive cancer, most often you don't get a pathologic complete response with chemo, and the ones that really you get a pathologic complete response rate with are the ones that are ER-negative or HER2-positive. And when you think back to the Oncotype score, there is some data from Italy showing that in a trial of preoperative chemotherapy, that if you get a PCR, almost all the patients have a high recurrence score, which makes intuitive sense, and no patients with a low recurrence score get a PCR. So I think that one area that we are interested in is where we should utilize pre-op hormonal therapy. So I think what would be an interesting trial to do, which I'm trying to get off the ground, would be having patients with ER-positive cancers in the preoperative setting and basically deciding how you're going to treat them based on the oncotype assay. So, for example, if they have a high recurrence score, you know already that they're going to be chemosensitive cancers, so giving them pre-op chemo makes sense. But if they have a low recurrence score, then they're not likely to get a great response from chemo, and maybe using preoperative hormones in that setting would make the most sense, and maybe randomizing the intermediate group similar to the Taylor-X study.
Well, you know, my understanding of the oncotype is that the three key components there are ERPR, proliferation, and HER2. And I guess the question is, could you just get really good ER, HER2, and some, I don't know, Ki-67 or some of these other proliferation things and, you know, be able to achieve the same thing?
Well, the answer is I'm sure that you could, but the problem is we're not very good at quantifying these proteins that stands right now, particularly the hormone receptors. I think that we kind of all do IHC, but it doesn't really tell you very accurately the quantity of the protein that's there. And certainly that's a component of the oncotype test, in that you're measuring these genes much better than you did before. We're better with HER2-NU, obviously, and obviously HER2-NU is a different issue because you're going to use trastuzumab. And Ki-67 historically really hasn't been all that useful. So I think that it's true that I think we will reach a point where perhaps if we're better at measuring these proteins and genes, we may get very similar information to the oncotype assay. But there was data at San Antonio this year basically showing that all the genes, even the miscellaneous genes, appear to be very important. So I think for now, the fact that it kind of multiplexes all the genes together is really its key advantage. And obviously, going back to the nanotechnology techniques that we're trying to develop, that's something that we would like to do, is multiplex the proteins on a single slide and quantify them. But I think the other thing that's very interesting is the fact that, especially for progesterone receptor, the protein appears to be more important than the gene. At San Antonio this year, there was two very interesting presentations, one from the oncotype assay, basically showing that it appears that the expression of quantified PR gene actually doesn't correlate with benefit from tamoxifen. And then I think there's plenty of data out there saying that the PR protein is very important in benefit from tamoxifen. So it is an interesting protein because it's post-translationally modified. So I think that in that instance, the protein may be more important to look at compared to the gene. But I think that the oncotype just offers a very easy way of basically dividing patients into groups and deciding who needs chemo and who doesn't.
What were your thoughts about the stuff they presented? A whole bunch of stuff at San Antonio, like all of a sudden looking at their database of whatever 20,000 cases and a lot of stuff on, as you say, individual components of that. What was your takeaway from all that?
Well, I think the message that they were giving is that the test in itself, because of the fact of the different genes it looks at, that on its own it certainly is validated, but looking at the individual genes, it didn't appear that it was as robust as the test taken as a whole. They had several presentations looking at one of the things we were just talking about, measuring estrogen receptor, and certainly their gene assay appears to be more robust in predicting benefit from tamoxifen compared to either ER protein measured by IHC or even ligand binding.
Well, also, they see, you know, variations in the level of, for example, estrogen receptor protein that were huge, like by the thousands different or something. Was that your take?
That was definitely my take on this. And I think we know that this probably happens. And I think we've been very simplistic for years in terms of how we quantify that protein, even though we all know it's important. And I think the progesterone receptor is really fascinating because I think at least the oncotype assay would tell you at the protein level that progesterone receptor is more important than estrogen receptor in terms of hormone sensitivity.
Can you kind of go back over the study that did look at the oncotype as it relates to pre-op therapy?
Yes. So this was an Italian study. It was actually done at the very early development of the assay. And what they did was they basically took patients with, I believe they had locally advanced breast cancers, did a core biopsy, which they sent for the RT-PCR-based oncotype assay. They then gave them pre-op chemo, which was an anthracycline taxane-based regimen. And then they correlated pathologic complete response rate with the oncotype assay. And what they found was that in the low recurrence score group, which was less than 18, which is what we're still kind of using at this time point, there was no pathologic complete responses. All the pathologic complete responses were in the high recurrence score group, except one, which was in the higher end of the intermediate group, which really does validate a little bit further doing the Taylor-X study to try and work out where your cutoff is in terms of chemosensitivity. And I think my take from this study would be, well, it makes sense because ER-positive cancers don't get PCRs as much as they do with ER-negative. HER2-positive high-grade cancers, you tend to get PCRs. So I thought it made perfect sense.
So your idea would be if they have low recurrence score, give them endocrine therapy?
That would be my idea. And I know certainly we are doing that for some older patients, but I really believe that even in a younger patient, if her tumor is really being driven by the estrogen receptor, that it's really the fact that chemotherapy is really not going to benefit her. I mean, that's really the issue I think we're struggling with. And everything we've seen before is the pre-op setting is almost always the same as the post-op setting. So to me, it would make intuitive sense that we should look at the assay in the pre-op setting.
One of my favorite people to interview over the years has been Mike Dixon from the UK, who's done a lot of neoadjuvant research on endocrine therapy. And it's kind of hard to look at his work and try to compare, for example, what they see with AIs to what we see, I guess, with chemotherapy. What's your take on? And there's a lot of other people over there who've done stuff like that.
I think the problem with pre-op hormonal therapy is we do not know what a valid endpoint is. One prime example of that is when you think back to Matt Ellis' study, which was looking at clinical response rate based on HER2 status, you would think looking at that data, oh, an aromatase inhibitor is going to be much better at HER2-positive cancer compared to tamoxifen. But now we have data from the two large upfront adjuvant trials showing that, in fact, in the HER2-positive population, there is no difference between the aromatase inhibitor and tamoxifen. My personal opinion is that I think that all HER2-positive cancers are somewhat intrinsically hormone-resistant.
Yeah,
and to me, you know, we have plenty of data saying that, you know, tamoxifen just doesn't work as well if you've got a HER2-positive cancer. What didn't make any sense to me was why the aromatase inhibitors would be better. There was lots of theories thrown out there, but your target is the same for aromatase inhibitors and tamoxifen. You know, it's the estrogen receptor. The other thing I think that was presented again at the meeting was the TANDEM study, which was the metastatic study with the hormone receptor positive HER2-positive cancers. And if you recall in that study, the time to progression, the anastrozole alone arm was 2.4 months.
Of course, that's metastatic, yes.
It's metastatic, but that's extremely low. And in fact, the clinical benefit rate on the trastuzumab anastrozole arm was almost identical to Dr. Vogel's single-agent trastuzumab trial, which begs the question of, at least in some patients, what is the hormonal therapy doing in these HER2-positive cancers? The data that was presented at San Antonio this year would certainly suggest that that's something that we're going to have to watch very closely. You know, I think one of the issues is, would we have the guts to do a trial where you actually didn't give hormonal therapy to patients with ER-positive cancers if they were HER2-positive, for example? But I think we have to be very careful because I think all these things are a spectrum, and I think that it may depend on the quantity of HER2 protein or gene that's present or the quantity of ER and PR that's present. I think these things are a spectrum, and I think we really have to answer the questions in a more prospective manner before we would decide to do that. But I think there's certainly an intriguing data suggesting that perhaps the HER2-positive cancers, even if they're hormone receptor positive, are really being driven by HER2-new. And I think this data would suggest to me that in an ER-positive, HER2-positive cancer in the adjuvant setting, I might be more likely to use trastuzumab than maybe I would have been before I'd seen this data.
And this data being the TANDEM data.
The TANDEM data. And I think the fact that in the two large adjuvant trials that you're not seeing this difference between tamoxifen and A. I think that my reading of that is more information basically saying that these cancers are perhaps intrinsically hormone resistant.
I guess, though, in terms of whether to use hormones or not, considering the relatively favorable side effects profile, that I don't know that we think that there's no benefit of endocrine therapy in these tumors.
I think we may find that there isn't. There's very little, but right now we do not know that, and I certainly would not encourage anybody to not use endocrine therapy.
And as you mentioned, it could be that, I mean, Ken Osborne and other people have talked about the interaction between HER2 and ER, and maybe by blocking HER2, it'll actually allow the hormone therapy to work better.
That's right. I mean, I think that's really the issue. And you could take that out of the TANDEM trial, because you do see a doubling in time to progression with the aromatase inhibitor and with Herceptin, although I have to say, it could just be from the use of the Herceptin. And if they'd had a Herceptin-only arm in that trial, I think that would have been very interesting to look at. You know, and I think also HER2-new probably plays a very significant role in an acquired hormone resistance as well.
Any other trials that you're interested in doing?
Well, we are interested in trying to get some trials specifically in the metastatic setting for triple-negative cancers. Again, trying to work out, you know, what the best regimen for those patients are. We are involved with a trial with Vanderbilt, which is looking at erlotinib and an mTOR inhibitor in unselected metastatic breast cancer. And I think that would be an interesting trial to see if maybe the triple-negative cancers do respond a little bit better. One of the problems...
You just saw like one response, clear-cut objective response to that combination, I'd be interested.
I would too, absolutely. One of the problems, of course, is that it just gone through the phase one part, and the toxicity of the two agents is quite significant, particularly in terms of mucositis. So they're kind of struggling about whether they should go on with the phase two part or not. But, you know, I think obviously if you made some adjustments in the drug dosages, that might be a reasonable thing to look at. So that's one thing certainly we're looking at. There is data suggesting that platinums may be more effective in these patients, so that's something else that we'd like to look at. We have a very large population of patients with triple negative cancers, so I think we are in a good position to examine agents in this setting.
I remember when Kathy Miller presented the E2100 data that Eric Weiner did the discussion afterwards, and one of the points he raised was the issue of bevacizumab and triple negative tumors. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so if you look, subsequently we did see a breakdown of 2100 looking at that data, and obviously, you know, across the board, the addition of bevacizumab did improve outcome compared to paclitaxel alone. The triple negative group clearly did benefit because the ERPR negative group in that trial were essentially triple negative because there was no patients with HER2 positive cancers on that trial. But interestingly, the hormone refractory patients also achieved a very significant benefit from the addition of bevacizumab. So that data wouldn't suggest to me that the triple negatives are perhaps particularly sensitive to the angiogenesis inhibitors, but it certainly would suggest that they do work. There was also a very intriguing presentation at the ASCO meeting from the SWOG group looking at a metronomic chemotherapy approach in the pre-op setting. I don't know if you recall that or not.
That was Georgiana Ellis.
Yes. So it was basically AC given metronomically followed by Taxol versus standard AC and paclitaxel. And overall, the metronomic arm was better, but in the ER negative group, the PCR rate was extremely high. I believe it was 45%. So again, that would lead some credence to the fact that perhaps these are sensitive to an angiogenic inhibition approach. So again, I thought that was an interesting protocol.
You hear people talking about the issue of metronomic therapy and being, quote, anti-angiogenic. How strong is the evidence on that?
I mean, there certainly is, as always, lots of preclinical data suggesting that it does have an anti-angiogenic effect. I'm not sure that we've really clarified for sure that's what it does in clinical trials, but I think I haven't seen data from this pre-op trial addressing that, but you would imagine that that would be a very nice way of basically looking at the effects of the agents on angiogenesis inhibition.
It seems like all the pre-op trials and the cooperative groups are about to sort of undergo a transition and seem like they're going to be more important, more of them, more tissue. Is that something you think is going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main interest in preoperative chemotherapy is the tissue acquisition issue to answer all these questions that we have questions about. And of course, this is fairly recent because I remember when I was at Northwestern, we did a trial with pre-op TAC and we didn't actually look at the tissue. I mean, we probably should have been. But I think that it's such a unique place to actually be able to really, because I think we all believe the pathologic complete response rate for after preoperative chemotherapy is a very robust marker of outcome. And you have a very quick way of basically correlating whatever expression of whatever is in a tumor with your PCR rate. Even in the B27 trial that was negative, they still found the PCR did correlate with outcome. But I think going back to the preoperative hormonal trials, that may be the endpoint we should look at, but that's a real issue that we need to tweak out. And that's why the type of trial that I was talking about doing with the Oncotype assay is very difficult because, you know, you don't want to do a huge trial where you're going to look at disease-free survival as your endpoint. So it really does have a lot of nuances with it that make it kind of quite complicated.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.